Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about consequences of the Einstein-De Haas experiment and effect. So, what you do is you get a iron bar and you spin it on a very fine fishing thread. I would actually recommend an optical fiber because it's a glass holder, and this makes a torsion pendulum, so you can put little markings on it and you can actually get it to spin left and right and it will slowly come to rest. You may want to protect it from air eddy currents and stuff like that, and I don't know how you would actually put it to rest. You'd probably have a platform underneath it which just raises an oil bath up and slows it down, then you lower it down, the oil bath lets go. That would be a way of reducing the vibrations. And then around the outside of it, you put lots and lots of coils, wire coils, and you have a computer-controlled current source which gets the magnetic field going north towards you and then south towards you. And this is the coils going around this area. And perhaps, I think, what I was thinking, you make it, because it's actually not too hard to make this magnetic field, I would perhaps have a fairly large one and have a ring of magnetic fields at the top and a see-through and ring of magnetic fields down the bottom. So and make it really, really large. So in the center, you've got a fairly uniform magnetic field. And you would find the actual torsion, the frequency of natural oscillation of this device, and put a square wave on it. In fact, you could actually have a computer monitoring the deflection. And so as the deflection reached its peak and it wasn't going to be pushing any more, it would reverse it and start pushing the other way, pretty much like a father pushing their people, the kids on a swing. You wait till the actual kid comes up to the top, and then when they're beginning to go down, you push it to do it there. So that's a closed circuit, which actually really you can set off, but it will actually find and hunt the maximum oscillation. And the Haas effect, Einstein-De Haas effect, is that when you flip the magnetic fields, so if you change from north to south, south to north, you flip all the actual components inside. Now, for myself, I somehow prefer ferrite because it's less complex the thing, and it's not a you want a step function such that you create eddy currents in it and they die out and then over a very short period of time. I like ferrite as well because it's basically iron, less dense. If you've got pure iron, you can sort of work out it's got sort of the maximum number of iron particles there. So the spin, so there's two components. There's the orbital positioning of the iron in the atomic orbit, and there's also the spin. Now, the spin gives you twice as much magnetization per angular momentum shift. So swapping a spin state from up to down is an H of angular momentum, which has got units of meters squared, or meters times meters per second, kilograms. It is an angular momentum unit. So the H flipping means that the magnetic field flipping induces a torque. And so this effect, you can actually start this up spinning. Now, you get a factor of two reduction in the amount of push that you get for your flip, or you get for the amount of push you get, you'd get a factor of two improvement. So Although magnetic field change comes easily, the magnetic field response is twice as much for the amount of flip, so the push is half as much, and this is where the de Haas Einstein becomes really interesting, because they didn't know about this factor of two, and they weren't. Einstein, I think, in the group could have swayed them to, because it believed the theoretical value that Einstein had predicted, and they found the experiment showed it. And in fact, it's not this this difference is not there, and so that they observed a factor of one when they should have observed a factor of close on two. So what happens is it's not all spin, some is angular, some of it's the atomic classical view, and so it's sort of classical and quantum fractal. So we're all quantum, but the one's purely spin, which is sort of a pretty amazing thing. It's got spin of an electron is amazing, because it's 720 degrees angular rotation. So if you had an electron and you could mark an electron with a scratch on the outside and rotate that electron around, you'd have to rotate it 360 degrees. You'd see another surface of the electron you hadn't seen before, and rotate it again and twice, and you see it again. And so this is the the gyromagnetic, the G factor for the electron. And it's a sort of an interesting thing that the angular momentum is not such a big deal due to the fact that it's spin. And so it's very much set in the universe come across. So it's a thing that you can actually build and show. And Einstein at the time believed Ampere's explanation of magnetic fields in magnets. In the magnet, there are tiny little atoms, are tiny electromagnets. Okay, so an electromagnet produces a magnetic field. A piece of atom produces a magnetic field. So therefore, unless we can think of a whole new physics, which of course we have done, we thought of quantum physics, inside the atom it has to be a tiny little electron. It must be going around and around all the time with no loss. It must be a superconductor circuit going inside. It goes around inside in a circle, and it produces a magnetic field. And by magic, again, we don't understand it, we can flip that magnetic field. We can get it to flip the opposite direction. And when it flips the opposite direction, it transfers angular momentum. So that's what Einstein believed. And of course, that this is sort of consistent with the belief around that time prior to quantum mechanics. Now, unfortunately, you listen to teachers nowadays explaining permanent magnets to people, and they will tell you quite seriously that inside an atom is a little electron, and the electrons are flowing around. And if you draw atoms flowing around, you actually put them next to each other, currents cancel out on the inside until you get a net current around the outside, which produces the magnetic field. Which, of course, there is this physics in which the electrons don't have to physically move in our... eventually, as you increase scales, they do move. And the reason why you can't say that they move is because you can't actually put an actual mark on an electron wave function and see that wave function rotate around. You can't actually put a mark on an electron and see it rotate and spin. So it's unlike if I have a top and I'm spinning it, I can put a mark on it and I can see that mark go around and around. Of course, the electron doesn't have that amount of information in it. And it's sort of interesting to see it, and it's all very linked into the fact that there is an absolute frame of rotation, and rotation is frozen under the universe. So it's a very interesting effect to see. But there again, it's also intensely interesting in terms of the inability to discuss Einstein's fatal flaw, where he was out by a factor of two and missed the dawn of spin. It required people, in actual fact, to take another part of Einstein's work and plug it into the quantum mechanics, which he was a bit wary of, and out came spin from the universe. It's a pretty amazing thing, and I'll have to go across it. But we come up to another thing, which is very obvious, that it's a bit of a question that you always ask, that if I can have a changing magnetic field, and that applies a rotation knock to an atom, so I change the field, the spins flip, electrons flip, they change their angular momentum, and to conserve angular momentum, the actual bulk turns the opposite direction. It's like a shotgun effect, or you know, a gun recoils the opposite direction. So if I can do that, surely I can do the opposite. And this is a question, the sort of routine things that you sort of go into a field. If you've got a tiny effect, you try and hit a resonance, and then the resonance picks this tiny effect up, it builds up. And that's how you can build a school demonstration of it. I don't know how long it would take for this effect to build up, probably an hour or something like that. You really want it to have no, be almost ideal if it was in a vacuum or something like that. You'd have no eddy currents affecting it whatsoever. But using resonances, sort of things, looking at how it does factors. This is a beautiful experiment, picking up what's spin and what's orbital angular momentum. That's really good. Magnetization, you've got spin magnetization and all that type of stuff. But there's another aspect of physics, is that things should be reversible, or if they're not reversible, it really tells you a lot of things. So and this reversibility is something which got Faraday flawed, and then Maxwell sort of solved it. So essentially you have to say, this is classic reversibility, you can move a wire in front of a magnet, but you can't, the magnetic flux lines which are in a magnet, although you imagine magnetic flux lines, what you could do is perhaps you can move a wire through a magnetic field, but if the magnetic field is uniform and you move the magnet, it has no effect. It's a sort of, this is a non-reciprocal nature. So if we, and that's basically, I don't know, it's your quantum effects. That really brings out light, quantum mechanics, that effect. So if I have a big, dirty big magnet producing a uniform magnetic field, if I move that, shake that magnet back and forth, that magnetic field actually doesn't change out there. You can't see it changing. But if I move the wire, shake the wire, I do see the current. Just trying to get, this is no fringing field. I've got a huge, huge magnet, and it's, you know, meters across, and I'm holding a wire in front of it in the middle of the center, and I shake that magnet a couple of millimeters, nothing happens. But if I shake the wire, something does happen. So it's sort of, you know, how does that all work? And that really got Faraday unplugged and launched us through. And so here we've got an effect that if I have an object and I suddenly change the magnetic field and it magnetizes and the spins flip on it, the flipping causes, the flip involves an angular momentum. So Planck's constant, H, is in units of action, which is energy seconds. So energy times inverse seconds, or Planck's constant times inverse seconds gives you energy. That's one way. It's also in units of angular momentum. And so you see that effect. So really the opposite should occur, that if I whack up the angular momentum, I will change the energy levels of the states, and I should be able to change the magnetization. So the magnetization is a vector. So the magnetization can be only aligned or counter-aligned with the weak, the I suppose in this case, the axis of rotation. So if I have a sample and it's there and it's not magnet, it's not a magnet, it will have as many electrons pointing up and pointing down. And so this is the Barnett effect. Now, the Barnett effect, it took this guy in 1905 to 1919, something of those years, 1910 to about 10 years, this guy, Barnett. And what he did is he spun things and measured a magnetic field. Now, this is mind-boggling. This is mind-boggling how you can measure anything. Bear in mind, they had less electrical noise about the place, but these are incredibly small currents. So if I have a coin and I spin it and I flick at the coin, that coin has a magnetic field produced in it by this Einstein de Haas effect reverse. And that magnetic field must be incredibly, incredibly small, a net magnetic field. So the everything inside a ferromagnet, the actual atoms themselves are intensely strong magnets, but they always cancel out. They're all cancelled out unless you lock them together. They have cooperative regimes, and they actually align with the local magnetic field, and the local magnetic field is caused by their alignment, and so it locks in. You get these bubbles. It's also interesting seeing that in ferrite bubbles in Faraday rotators. It's sort of magnetic bubbles. Okay, but we won't go into that too much. And so it's only when you actually go through the periodic table time and time again, which you know that I've done, that you come up to the element galdenum. I can't pronounce it. I've never spoken to people about it. I've written letters to people about it, sort of talking about it. And it's the love child of this 2010 onwards, and people are discovering it, and they're putting it in optical fibers, and it's got just an insane number, a technically insane number of unaligned electrons, that is, electrons which are available to show their spin. So some atoms might have one, some atoms, it has eight atoms, and eight is just mind-blowing, and it is mind-blowing. So it's in the F block, it's the transition metal in the F block, and it's the eighth element along. Now, the F blocks have got 14 elements. Now, bear in mind that majority of your periodic tables have 15 elements in the F block, and that's just complete in-your-face rubbish. It's just really offensive, quite honestly, that people put the lutetium at the end of the F block when it's actually in the D block up there. It's just the printers, people just said, do you approve this? And the people working on the periodic table, they haven't spoken to them. They've spoken to the marketers people, and it doesn't look nice. And okay, but getting back to Gundelum, so you've got, let's do the F block again. So it's the lanthanides, so the hidden, they're all rare earths. Well, going down the rare earths, you've got sandium, yttrium, and lutetium. Okay, they're in the D block. Leading up to lutetium, you've got lanthanum, cerium, praseodymium, neodymium, promethium, samarium, europium, so that's seven, and then gondolum, terbium, dysprosium, holmium, erbium, thulmium, and ytterbium. So they're all found, all these rocks, they're all Swedish names. And gondolum, I've really forgotten what gondolum is. Samarium, europium is this phosphor one, it's the red TV. Samarium is a sort of a second-rate magnet but it's got a negative temperature coefficient. So if you want a temperature independent magnet, you put some samarium, neodymium, its magnets, praseodymium is just the same as neodymium, but it's much rarer because it's an odd element. If it's got an even atomic number, it's very common. And so, goldium is this insane thing. So it's in the F block, but instead of, as you go up to 8, you would expect the next electron there to be unaligned, also an F block, and so there'd be only 6. So what happens is you get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 electrons spun, and normally as you go down, it would go then 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, down to, I suppose, none. None as it lined up. I just have to think about how that's it's done. Yeah, it's go one to none. So you'd expect yttrium. So yttrium and yttrium sound very similar because they're named after the same Swedish mining town. It means outer village. Trium, it means outer. And trium means town, out town. And like downtown, and they've just had, and so erbium and terbium is, you know, trying to actually get the name of this place, which is just now just sort of a locality on an island in off Stockholm around there. So love to visit it one day. It's one of my great things to visit that. But goldium is insane because rather than its 8th electron being a well-behaved F electron which goes the opposite spin, it's got a D. It's a D electron, a D orbital thing sitting in the middle of the F block. It's got this mad, it's so magnetic, it's not funny. So goldium is, gondolum, I can't pronounce it, I'll find out how you pronounce it properly, is the go-to element. If you had to spin any element and see magnetic effect, this would be it. And this is indeed what's happened in, I think, 2015, 2017, not many years ago. People have got a core of this gondolum. This is the modern version of it, where it's actually been definitively measured. And it's the fact that if you spin something fast enough, it will develop a magnetic field. Okay. And you say, oh, this is hard to believe. Well, it's a very small effect, but the most powerful one, and they've got it in an air turbine, which sort of gives me the frights because it looks like it's a little laboratory air turbine, and it sounds absolutely insane. So it goes up to a rotation speed of 1,500 revs per second, which sounds a lot. It's an air turbine, but it's, I don't know, for the sample size, the entire thing is, look, 10,000 revs is something that I think would be seriously frightening. It seems, look, I'm sure they've designed it well, but I'm sure that aerospace engineers would be able to know exactly how to build the bearings and everything on this, so it would stay true. But bear in mind that these getting things to spin at high speed requires there's a lot of energy involved in it. So it's like it's like a driving a car. As you double speed, you more than increase 4 times the amount of energy. So going from 15 to revolutions per minute to 1500 revolutions per minute, you've got 10,000 times more energy stored in there. So there's a fair amount of energy stored in there. So I can imagine that you'd be a bit nail-biting to see this sort of thing spin up. So you've got a little sample, which is like a little tube, a little slug, like a shotgun pellet, full of it, gondolum, and it's spun at high speed, and there's magnetic pickup coils, and as it spins up, it indeed magnetizes. And what's more than that, it fits the formula exactly. Like, there is a formula there which says that there's this effect, but beneath a transition temperature, above a transition temperature, thermal effects start to knock it over. So what happens is that it's spinning up and it decides that it will, you'll get a population inversion or a population of spin up versus spin down will change because of the amount of spinning. Now this is just sort of insane. It really is getting me thinking because it's such an in your laboratory, you don't have to look out to the edge of space. You don't have to look at the end of space-time to see this. You spin this up, and as you spin it up, the magnetic field grows. And so as you put on your foot on the accelerator and it goes higher up, you can imagine this making a hell of a lot of sound. 1,500 would make a fairly... making a fair amount of noise and a fair amount of fear. Oh, I'd be frightened of it. Going to the lab, you'd see this stuff. Now, in terms of Tesla, I think the Earth's magnetic field is a milli Tesla, and this is 1,000 times weaker. Yeah, they're picking this up, but one would wonder exactly how one does it. I could, imagine for me, I think what I'd like to do is put some magnetic shielding on half of it. So it would be balanced, but it would give an oscillating signal. I don't know how they do it. And of course, oscillating signals is what you want to get, because you can, in the oscillation, you cancel out the DC component, and then you can do a whole heap of measurements with it. But they've got this absolutely nailed complex effect. It's called the Barnett effect, and they've got it completely nailed. And so it's interesting. On one aspect, you've got the Einstein effect, which proved... was set up and proved a theory, which then was, so their results went on with Ampere's theory, the very old classical theory, and then the results were proven to be wrong. And so, like, it proved the old way wrong, and introduction Einstein was at one point, and what happened is that the work that he did 10 years earlier came across into the quantum equation, got spin, got your factor of 2, and then the factor of 2 is not there, it's 2.002, there's a 1%, no, not a 1%, a 0.1% deviation, which the scientists can pick up, and that has come from the next generation of physics. This is virtual particles, this is field theories gone mad, coming across, and so you've got the Barnett effect, so you've got this effect coming up, showing you quantum mechanics, and then you've got the Barnett effect, which is going back to it, showing you the symmetry of the idea that if I apply an alternating magnetic field, I get a push, and if I give it a high angular momentum, by changing the angular momentum of it, I can see it's there. What's sort of amazing in all of this, is that all the threads are coming through, but they're not been yet tied together in a tapestry. So you've got all the spin effect coming into fermions, explaining the bulk of matter, why matter is bulky, and people really aren't asking that question. But it's the rotational invariance, or the absolute rotational stuff. So in Einstein's laws of physics is firstly inertial frames and then non-inertial frames. Now this is accelerating frames. This is general relativity works for accelerating frames. Getting towards, he stopped, and then we got into, all frames, all inertial, non-inertial, frames and all gauges. It became gauge invariant. This is whether I use a meter stick or what exactly I'm measuring. That's sort of the approach in, I get the same physics no matter what assumptions I start. However, sitting at the base of this, which is really intense, is the rotational invariance, or the absolute rotation of the universe, which gives, through special relativity, spin, and it gives the fact that I can be in a lift, I could be anywhere, and I could tell you for sure if it's spinning or not, because I can feel my arms being pulled out, and how does that work, that rotational comes across, and it's linked beautifully in that as I spin, I create a magnetic field, and that is something to really, really think about on two levels. One is how deep it is, what a deep to get your thought in, and also what sight is like, in that we miss the Einstein de Haas experiment. It's a very relaxed, simple, not hard to do. There's no frame of reference, there's no square roots, there's nothing complex, no complex numbers, no Malowski space or anything like that. There's no general, it's a fairly simple, homey thing. That's out by a factor of two, done and dusted. And it's an experiment you can set up in the school. Just get an iron bar, magnetic field changing, spin, you can set it up pretty much. The other one you can't set up, but you just have to question, how did someone over 100 years ago get an experimental result when we now know we've got the periodic table, which has given us something which is a factor much bigger, and we've got the speed rate. Now, the thing which has really clinched it is that every last detail of it is undone with the actual formula. This is the magnetic susceptibility slowly switches off with temperature. So that's a factor to see that effect done. And so you can see that as you bring it up above room temperature, it works perfectly as room temperature, but as you increase the temperature ever so much, it begins to thermally scramble itself. And it's sort of just imagine what's going on. And there's so much physics to understand what's going on. So I thought I'd have that little aside, and it's called the Barnett effect. And if I get a coin and I flick it, and the coin is rotating, there is a small magnetic field, nanotesla. If it's a gondolin coin, or the better, if it's an iron coin, nickel coin, it's anything which has got next spin, the angular momentum I impart to that. And so all of those things, even though that's got spatial angular momentum, each atom itself, electron there, doesn't feel the pull inside. It's actually rotating. I'm rotating it very slowly. It will have a small preferential net magnetization, and will, as you spin it along the axis that it's spinning, it will go north and south. And if you spin it the opposite way, the north will go the opposite direction. And that's something amazing. It's true and it's obscure, but let's go and consider it. Thanks for listening. Podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.